Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Omar Elturai, your host and director of research at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund-level intelligence. I'll be filling in for Cole today, who's under the weather, but he'll be back on the next episode. I'm excited to share that we have a special guest with us today. So I'm joined by Shlomo Chop of Case Equity Partners. Shlomo is a seasoned real estate professional with more than two decades of experience, touching all stages of the property life cycle and phases of business plans, investing up and down the capital stack, and in various CRE-related services. As a managing partner of Case Equity Partners and founder of Case Property Services, Shlomo has a unique perspective from his time spent in advisory, restructuring, investing, asset and property management, and even inventing, as he holds four patents for innovative retail solutions. So Shlomo, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Omar. Thank you so much for having me.
And just to kick the conversation off, can you tell us and I guess the listener a bit about yourself and how you got started on your career path?
Wow. I really did not go to college. I went for a bit. I took a few marketing courses. And then I just want to go out and make money. But I couldn't do it simple. It's not like I went out and bought something and just sold it out on the market. It wasn't like I became a trader. I'm like, okay, I want to do this right. So I started out working at a flooring company, commission only, because, hey, we were going to knock it out of the park. Sold commercial flooring. Got my first taste of cold calling. You literally would pitch to like UPS, just facility managers and try to sell them this commercial flooring that was the greatest thing since sliced bread at the time I was selling it. And then in the building where I worked, there was a real estate guy and I was curious and I learned about real estate and he was an operator, not a broker, although he was one of these guys that would always be buying, always be selling, but he was really about, okay, we would buy, it was a shopping center. We'd buy a shopping center with a Kroger of doing $350, $400 a foot. That was on a shorter term lease. He knew they were going to renew and it had some vacancy and it was mismanaged and to turn that thing around. And I got enthralled with it and I continued down that path. And over time, what I realized is that my angle, my approach into the business is not because daddy gave me money, he didn't have to give me. It's about I inherited the genetics and a good brain. And use that to say, okay, what's my edge? What am I doing that's different? I'm not going to do what everyone else does because then it's just like, why him? Why me? Like, why would I outdo anybody else? Or why would I be the one to get chosen to be invested with? It was just a mindset at the time that I had. And over time, I just taught myself, avid reader, just doing, and just get up, pull up your bootstraps, and just do what the opportunity presents you. And form this expertise, this knowledge at levels that people really don't want to form. And that's who we are.
I guess the various roles from flooring to where you are now, were there different phases or have you always just chasing your curiosity and interests?
Oh, of course, there are different phases. Started out with I had nothing to worry about. I was at home, my parents paid for everything, and hey, we'll just go sell flooring. And if I don't make any money, it's not a big deal either, right? Although, of course, we were going to make lots of money. But the story is that I was working at flooring and then I decided I needed something more. Went to work for Uncle in the kitchens business, was selling kitchens to real estate owners and developers and basically would design the thing on my own. Like I'd go into a developer and say, look, I made you this great concept, this great design, buy it for me. And it was a maturation process. And then I started getting serious. I started, you know, dating, got married, and I needed a job. So I went to work for a real estate software company doing $750 a week plus healthcare. And my dad's a computer programmer. So I used to help him I knew tech and still do, which is a secret I don't really like telling people. And this was 2003. This is before there was something called prop tech, right? It was very not glorified at the time. And I became knowledgeable as it relates to different real estate businesses, how they operate. And I would go into large companies and see what their operations are and see how it comes together. So I'd see everything from all different perspectives. And there was the need for dollars, the need for a salary that brought me to that level. And then at a certain point, I essentially went on my own. I essentially just said, heck, if those guys could do all those deals, I could do all those deals. Well, it turns out, yeah, I could do deals. I could get screwed in the process, which I did a lot. But with time, developed a niche, developed a situation where others are unable to compete with what it is that I do. I believe I do it better than others do, not because I'm smarter, because I've taken a different approach I think is core. And we could talk a little about that approach, but essentially it's not that I'm providing a service to a borrower, if you will, but rather I am almost injecting myself into his business and how he operates and figuring out from the inside out what to do. It's not to the extent of where they think the solution needs to be, but where we think we need to go to actually make a solution happen. And I'll get to talk more about that as we move forward. And that's how it evolved. And it's still evolving, my friend. It's still evolving. Life's a, you're either growing or you're going, as they say, or as I say at least. So there you go.
Yeah. And so you started going into it. I think what you're probably known for, I think you have a pretty diverse CV, which maybe we can come back and talk about that. But can you talk a bit about Case and describe the firm and really the lines of business and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So Case Equity Partners was born a bit of a necessity, as everything in my life has been. So I started Case Property Services in 2010, advising borrowers on distressed assets. It started out due diligence, and then eventually we advised borrowers that were in distress, did a bunch of workouts, made some money, and in 2016 had a huge accounts receivable, millions, and had to litigate in some instances, but fight for every last dollar of collecting those monies. Because I was the guy that people said, oh, let's give him a shot. Why not? Like the first time around, right? It was like, you know, did I have a track record? Yes. But tell me which deal you've done that fit the following set of arbitrary criteria that I think it matches. And I had to fight uphill for every single engagement that I got. I was the guy that people didn't think of calling me first, if you will. We had to cold call people. And then it's like, hold on, you're cold calling me to help me with my issues. You must be a real great guy because you had to cold call me. And by the way, how do you even know I'm in distress, right? So the point is I had to fight my way up. But ultimately, at that time, I needed to figure out what to do because in 2016, there wasn't much distress to work on at the time because interest rates, you know, came down and the market recovered pretty quickly. So I called a friend of mine, Dover Benowitz, Superior Realty Group, real estate family office. And I said, hey, why don't you back me? Like, let's buy things together. And got into that line of the business. And I'm just a problem solver. I can't help it. I can't help fiddling, right? And looking at retail at the time was a bit of an issue, because retail obviously was dead. The store was over. Everything was online, e-commerce. No one's ever going to go to a store ever again. And I'm like, there's got to be a better way to do it, which is how the patents came about. But over time, as the stress started finding its way back in, people were asking around who to call. And at that point, from the GFC, I had a string of really great successes. Heck, I think I hit a 70% success rate.
Wow.
Okay, which the average workout, you probably got like a 40% chance of success. But I came in at the right time. 2008, when the market declined big time. And then 2010, when I was starting. So as I was getting into it, lenders were doing deals and my approach to doing deals sort of resounded with people and I was able to get it done. So I had a track record and it just picked up at that point and came back in. So for Case Equity Partners was an investment vehicle that we created. Case Property Services is the restructuring side of it. It really is two separate businesses, but now what I'm finding is this time around is that we're using our expertise on the restructuring side to make investments. We're talking about making investments in securities, making investments in properties, making investments in debt, and making investments in restructures, if you will, which is extremely difficult. I get calls all the time. Hey, we invest in distress. You got a distress deal for me, buddy. Let me just put it to you very straight. Most deals that you see restructured, you're not going to be willing to invest at that deal level, A. B, you're going to have to act very quickly. C, you're not going to like to structure the deal either because it's meant to be done with a borrower. So for you and me, you potential investor and me to get on the same page, we'd have to create a programmatic relationship. And unless you prepare to invest that time and energy and focus on it and learn about it, it's not going to work. And the problem is that so many, even at the largest of institutions, the mindset is deal, 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 deal. It's a disease, honestly, because they got to put out money. The mindset is like, okay, I have a certain amount of hours in a day. How many deals can I knock out? How much money can I deploy? Because that's how I make my fees. I'm not a match for any of those people. So over time, like what we're doing now is actually investing in a creative manner where we have that expertise. We understand it. We're starting from the beginning. We're starting to look at it as an investment from the beginning of the workout process, as opposed to just showing up at the end. Nevertheless, we don't invest in advisory deals that we do. Meaning if we do a restructuring for a client, we won't put capital into that type of deal. And the primary reason for that, to be frank, is that it's a conflict of interest. At the end of the day, if we have a deal and the guy doesn't have money, it could be an issue, but I usually try to weed that out ahead of time. I won't take on a guy that's just basically rent a guarantor syndications. I've done a couple of those and it just didn't turn out where the guy was able to even follow along with the advice because he had other considerations. So we don't really focus on that. So that's really a little more color as to what it is that we do in day to day and how the couple of pieces that seem really, oh, you're running two large corporations is really one thing intertwined with the other.
It sounds like you have a rather disciplined due diligence process. Can you speak a bit to whether you're assessing a deal for investing on the investing side or if you're considering a client and before you really take the case? How do those differ and what goes into your due diligence?
It's funny because in commercial real estate today, you have two types of people. You have the investor that goes with their gut. And you have the guy that works off a checklist. They both fail in today's market. You can't do that. You have to manage the gut with the data. And what you'll find is a couple of things. Someone told me the other day, he says, the best part of data is that it takes the emotion out of the process, right? You just look at the data and deal with it. The problem with that is that you can manipulate data to say whatever you want it to say. And if you don't believe me, just go look at loans going bad and just go look at the pro forma. He's like, how did they even believe that? You can manipulate, do whatever you want. So the way I assess borrowers that call me, the first thing is, the core thing is the lender going to be made whole? If the lender would clearly be made whole through that traditional process, your chances of getting a deal that you want, and let's be real, everyone wants a steal of a deal, right? Even if there is distress in place, they always want to steal, right? And especially if there's distress in place, I should say, they always want to steal. And the problem is it's a binary play, right? So let's say there's a seller selling something to a buyer. The seller knows it perfectly. You couldn't teach it to them if you wanted to. The buyer doesn't, but the buyer's got a very strong opinion as to what they'll be able to accomplish with it. So if a buyer thinks they could do better, the seller's like, good luck to you. Dream on, baby. Not for me. Have a good day. But when you're dealing with a lender is in recovery mode. A lender is saying, what are the ways that I can use, things I could use to recover the loan or the investment that I made? And the first rule of thumb is, if the property is in the money or close to it, it's going to be very difficult. There better be a really compelling reason for going to the lender for an issue. And B, there better be a very compelling proposal that the lender should say yes to. So the question is, can the lender accomplish what you want them to do for you without you? And if the answer is yes, then you got a problem. The answer is no, then you're okay. Then if the answer is yes, you can look at it and say, will they have a trouble getting to that point? And can your position within the property help accelerate a solution for them where the net loss to them doing a deal with you would be less than the net loss not doing a deal with you. And then, let's say that's the case, then you have to worry, you have to ask yourself, how hard of a convince is it, so to speak? So the first thing is the property. What's the lender's position? How's the lender going to see it? That's the key thing. And what do you want, borrower? And that's the criteria typically that we look at. People that come to the table with ridiculous asks often fit into that spread, and sometimes even in the hundreds of millions of dollars that they have a loan. There's this total disconnect or almost like cognitive dissonance between what the lender should want and feel versus what they would want and feel if they were the lender. And it's absolutely shocking. And it just shows people are human is really what it comes down to. So what I'm able to do is able to translate to this guy calling me saying, hey, here's your challenge. Here's how it's going to be seen. On the flip side, once I bring them on board, I can also work with a lender and say, I know that the first thing you do is look at your rights and remedies and your abilities, all that great and everything. But you got to look at the property. You got to keep your eyes on the prize as well. And that's where there's a debate as well. So try to be very selective who I take on board. And it also is not cheap either, right? Because we do a lot of work. It's a heavy lift the way we go about it. Some people like think, okay, it's called lender. It's not. Actually, if you called the lender without a proper plan, you could actually set yourself back dramatically, not only in your attempt to save the property, but also triggering recourse and things like that. Not because the conversation itself would trigger recourse. But I had a client that came to me after they went to another advisor. This client essentially grew his accounts payable dramatically. Okay, and this we're talking about a loan of nine figures. He grew his accounts payable dramatically. And what he would do, he would get his monthly disbursement from his cash management account. The lender controls the cash, pays out towards expenses. And he would then have to apply to expenses and then take distributions. Well, he took distributions, but he didn't always pay expenses. And he piled that up. Well, technically, it could be interpreted as a recourse trigger, especially on a limited recourse basis to the extent the lender has damages from it. His previous advisor he hired, I call him either a discount advisor or someone who just didn't like doing the work, just forwarded the accounts payable to the lender without asking, right? I'm not saying you should tweak it or change it. I'm just saying you made a move without understanding the implications. You would have been better off saying, sorry, we're not giving you any documentation. Go screw yourself. Come get it. To clean up the AP in the meantime by paying it off or settling with people and then maybe giving it afterwards, right? There's things you could do that's not lying, right? So you may say, why should I pay it off? Let the lender force me to pay it off. That's great, but you want to work out? Do you want the lender to believe that you're a deadbeat? You will not get a workout. So yes, you give it to the lender, and the lender can force you to pay it off, tell you to pay it off, and you pay it off, and you still won't have any exposure because you took care of the liens or potential liens or the list of the payables. But had you instead fixed it first, the lender wouldn't necessarily, unless they dug and asked for the right information, know that you were a deadbeat. The lender wouldn't have taken an aggressive position with you that they're not doing a deal with you, right? Or let's put it this way, a lender wouldn't take an aggressive position by default and not doing a deal unless you convince them by overpaying for it. So there's a lot of moving parts and people don't realize that. And the challenge becomes even more. And I know I'm sort of going off the question you asked, but these are very important points that borrowers must know. They figure they'll give it a shot this way, right? So when you come to me, once you try to fix it, you limit the amount of moves I can make and options I can make. You're narrowing down the focus. It's almost as if a broker tries to sell a property versus a owner tries to sell a property. When an owner sells a property, they're giving you basic information. Here, figure it out. Don't try me. That's a broker. They put together a beautiful package with six different turnaround scenarios. Now it's a binary play. It's like everyone's betting on the same type of scenarios because they all see it in front of them. Everyone has the numbers done for them, et cetera, right? Obviously, there's a good place where the broker didn't consider something. You have some additional knowledge or another way to go about it. Or the broker wasn't that great at what they did. Or you could get into the deal and realize that it's totally not what was represented. You could retrade it. But at the end of the day, you're dealing with a binary play. When you go to your lender first and try to give them a strategy and try to work through a strategy, you may be checking off the boxes to find yourself into a problem and say, oh, now I need a good workout guy. Yeah, of course you do. You need a magician. So that's really a chance. So when a guy calls me, I got to take the measure of the person, right? Guy or a gal, right? Got to take the measure of the person. Is this someone that you want to work with? Is this someone that'll listen? Is this someone that'll take direction? Is this someone that's questioning every move, not because they want to know, but because they think they know better? So you got to take the measure of the person. You got to take a measure of the property, the position that the lender will probably take. I take the measure of so many moves, also the market, liquidity. Will he have the dollars for it? He says he'll invest the money in it, but likely after you finish modeling the deal, you show it to him, is he just going to walk from it? Is he just going to walk from the deal? And is he just going to decide that, you know, I'm not going to ultimately invest in it? You just spent all this time charging him lots of money because it costs us lots to operate. But you're not going to make that bonus for success at the end, not because you're not delivering a deal relative to what's reasonable, but because you're not delivering a deal the guy's ready to execute on because he's never ready to execute a deal. So I hope that sort of helps the question. It's more than you ask, but I hope it helps.
I love it. It's a full response. You mentioned that some borrowers are almost maybe shooting from the hip or not necessarily thinking strategically when they initially react. Is that the biggest, I would say, stumble that a lot of borrowers have, reacting first as opposed to thinking through?
Yes, but to be fair, borrowers are not equipped to be strategic. To be strategic, you must understand where you're getting, right? You must understand the process because you can only plan for steps two. Strategy means you're putting together a plan to get you to steps two, three, four, to get you to the ultimate step, right? Ultimate conclusion. And it's like chess, right? You know what every move makes. You know the various moves, if you're a chess player. And you decide, like, what constructs am I going to put in place to succeed? The average borrower doesn't understand the process. I'll go further. The average borrower doesn't know what the loan document states. Even if they know it, they don't understand it. Even if they understand it, they don't understand how it could be interpreted. And even if they understand how it could be interpreted, they don't understand that just because they believe they are airtight and they could win in court, that the fact that there will be a court case will affect them negatively. Their name is on a court case. A lender on another property they're taking a loan from is going to ask a question. They won't take a loan. They can't take a loan. They're out of business. They have a problem, right? And even if they're not afraid of that and they believe they're going to be in court, do they really want to litigate for multiple years, worrying every day if they're going to pay? And oh, by the way, the loan documents say that if they lose, they have to cover the lender's costs. And the lender is not using the cheapest attorneys, which they usually are, because most top attorneys are conflicted out from doing deals with borrowers, especially on the larger lenders, especially on the CMBS side, because it's done that way. Basically, the lenders don't allow some of the larger firms to work with borrowers. There are conflicts. They don't waive conflicts. They don't even understand the process. They've never been through every step of this process to be able to strategize on day one how to get to where they need to get. Because if they would, they'd say to themselves, my business is buying properties. My business is turning around properties. This is a time suck. Maybe I shouldn't even chase this property. Or maybe I should actually get someone that knows what they're doing with this, right? So that's a significant issue. And it also explains, to be very frank with you, why the worst sales pitch I've ever seen, that is the most successful sales pitch in this industry, works, which is, hi, I golf with that guy. Okay. It works every time because that's what real estate people think. It's about, you know, the guy golf, right? So who is he? Other people that have the sales pitch, what are they bartering for you? Like, what are you? Are you the barter? Are you what he receives in return? And because no one's giving anything away for free. So that's the big issue. And that's really going back to your question. Borrowers cannot think strategically if they haven't gone through it. And once they go through it, they realize the moving parts. I spent 4 hours yesterday with a client explaining a complex set of three potential resolution options. 4 hours. Okay. Like, that's not even like all the other work that we've done to get us to a point of a resolution, right? So borrowers are not equipped to do it, not because they couldn't do it if they put their mind to it. I'm sure there are many guys that are sharp as tacks, probably smarter than me as well, but know what you do.
Who do you find yourself competing against?
The borrower.
Like, there are others in this industry,
people that are more expensive, one person that's more expensive than me, and then there are others that are out there, but at the end of the day, they're not my competition. The biggest competition is the borrower, because cash is tight, we're not cheap, and they don't know how to assess. It's like, give you an example, right? You need a lawyer. How are you assessing whether he's going to be a good lawyer for you or not? You sort of get it by reputation. That's it. But the problem with borrowers is they don't call up, hey, buddy, hey, Joe, how's it going? Right? Usually the conversation is, oh, I just closed on this deal. Oh, my God, you used to see I took care of that guy. But no, this was different. Hey, Joe, how's it going? Oh, man, I screwed up. I literally, like, this property is garbage and I messed up and I'm, who should I call for this, right? It's not going to happen, right? So you're not asking people. Yes, you're realistic about it. You tell who you need to tell. But that's not enough of a sample set. So the reality is that you get a guy like me that walks into your room, and within 15 minutes, you'll realize whether the person you're interviewing knows what to do or not. It's about how you feel when that person talks to you. Are you talking to someone who knows so much more than you do and also has a plan, has a strategy? My biggest issue is when I sit down with a borrower and they can't get over their fears. Oh, maybe I should continue paying it, or maybe I shouldn't bother the lender, he's my buddy, or maybe I should call the lender. Like, you're overthinking this thing. Let's fast forward 12 months. Tell me which one of these scenarios probably happened. And more than likely, it's that the lender went and asked for their money. We've seen money break up families. Someone dies, they inherit the money, and it's an issue. Why would that not happen to you in your relationship with your loan originator at a lender that's really not going to put his job on the line? Of course, it's going to happen. You need to really put yourself in the hands of somebody who makes you feel comfortable they could figure it out, and not outsmart yourself by hurting them and taking options off the table before they're able to actually do anything.
Has this strategic thinking and I would say plan, like very diligent planning, have you been able to bring this over to the investing side, or is that kind of a completely separate hat that you have to shift your mindset when you're looking to deploy capital?
Yeah, it's an interesting question that you're asking, because acquisitions, buying properties, is very much a lengthy process in practicality. But from a decision-making perspective, it requires quick action. If you really want a deal, you got to dig in right away. You got to come with the offer, right? And then it's hurry up, slow down. Deal will take forever. And time does kill deals, but you got to move very quickly. The challenge you have with distress is that most people buying distress buy it as a percentage of what it was worth previously. And it's one thing if you have the change in interest rates and values and you say to yourself, yeah, maybe values will come back, interest rates will adjust itself. But when you have seismic shifts in how we operate, when technology is taking over to the extent that it is, it takes a lot of effort. It's not just about opening up your Argus and pumping in the numbers and letting it do its magic and tweaking it and getting comfortable with what spits out and talking to your lender, right? It's a question of, what are you going to do to shepherd a property that's been envisioned in the 80s and the 90s or the 2000s and transform it into something that's viable the 2020s, 2030s, 2040s? All right, because let's be real, you got to sell to the next guy too. Okay, he's got to make a return too. And how are you leaving enough meat on the bone? So it's an issue. So for me, as somebody that really digs in a very big way, it could be a challenge to get comfortable with it. Like buying notes willy-nilly, pools of notes, I'm like, It really has never resounded with me in a very big way until the market starts recovering. Then you could bounce in. The beauty of it is that lenders don't really act until it's late. And once it's late, you see what's happening. So typically what I do is I focus on properties that are generational. Properties that have every reason in the world to recover to some value. The chance of them going to zero or lower than where it is today is mitigated. So that's the first thing. So even if I overpay for something, ultimately I'll have an asset. I'll have something I could work with. Second thing is I'll create my own deals. Very seldom do I work on deals that are brought to me through a broker. And it's not because I have an issue with brokers. It's because there's a clock ticking and there's always somebody that's going to make an aggressive move. Now, I've had situations where I've been on a deal and it's gone to market, and that's fine. And typically, I try to be the guy left over at the end of the day where I'm the guy that's there to do the deal as opposed to other people that haven't done as much work and haven't done as much diligence and therefore tap out early or come in at lower prices. So I try to get in early, do the work early, find an angle into the deal, right? Street purchase is great. Financing is tough. Cash is tight. So liquidity generally in the market is tight. So I need to find a way that I can get into a deal that has a very good return and I can perhaps outposition others by coming with a unique perspective to the table. And that's where the work outside of it comes to the table. So yes, it's very much a process. It's very much a lengthy process, but the goal is to have the juice be worth the squeeze. And that's how we try to do it.
That makes sense. And you mentioned that liquidity's tight, and I would say that it's probably been true for the last 2 years. What's your take on the current macro and market environment? And what are some of the themes that you've seen, whether it's from the restructuring side or from the investment side?
I think the macro environment is really weird. I don't understand it for a second. I think there's a lot of noise in the market. There's a lot of trades that don't make sense. There are some trades that I'm scratching my head about. And ultimately, anyone you ask, it comes down to they need to deploy capital, dollar cost averaging, right? And what that means is commercial real estate has become an institutional asset. And companies like Altus have benefited from that in a very big way, for sure, right? But at the end of the day, the analysis that goes into it assumes that operations will function properly, right? You're an acquisitions guy, not an operations guy, and you're going to buy, assume that the rest of the boxes will check themselves by people that are there in place. And that's great. But what are you indexing it to? What if the environment changes, right? We're not living in a laboratory, at least most of us. So at the end of the day, I have a huge concern with where the market is right now. I have a huge concern with the trades. But the reason I like it is because when they fall on their face, they'll be out of hope. And that gives me the ability to step in and do what needs to be done. But make no mistake about it. This is what people totally mess up. If people are out of hope, there's less liquidity in the market. So how are you going to make a deal? And that's the part that scares me. So we're undertaking certain efforts to mitigate that. But at the end of the day, when you buy the deal, the rest of the world is going to be like, oh, I wouldn't pay that. I wouldn't buy a deal right now. Oh, that's such a bad asset class. We've all heard it. Like retail is bad. Office is bad. But at the end of the day, you need to have conviction and reason behind the conviction. It goes back to the data combination with gut at the end of the day. And the gut really is just telling you what in the data that you're not realizing.
So it sounds like there's something that, and I'm going to try to dig, I'll try to dig a little bit deeper, but is there issue, whether in particular or just a general issue that you don't think the market is paying attention to? Because if you're seeing deals that you don't think make sense, like what is being missed?
I think what's being missed is the interconnectivity between the various components of the market. For starters, let's break down one thing at a time. People are talking about the fact that there aren't a lot of distressed sales. Okay. They're saying there aren't a lot of distressed sales because values necessarily aren't down and lenders are holding out. Great. But could we all agree that loans aren't being paid off? I think we could assume that for the most part, right? If loans aren't being paid off, banks, lenders are not getting the capital back. Banks, lenders aren't getting the capital back. They can't distribute to their investors, to the lenders as may be, to their depositors or satisfy the regulators. If that happens, then at a certain point, someone needs to raise liquidity. And yes, you can raise liquidity at a good price if you have good assets. Everyone's willing to buy it. But over time, there's more sellers than there are buyers. And that ticks it down. So just at a base level, let's be real, the market hasn't evolved entirely yet. And it's nothing that I know externally that's going to come and save us from chickens coming home to roost, right? Office buildings, any property that isn't an overnight or a year-to-year situation, leases roll. When leases roll, they adjust to market. How can office rents not adjust to market, especially on a net basis? We know even the best of deals right now are getting done with crazy TI dollars. And that all has a ripple effect. The cycle is all there, right? I could tell you, I know situations in the CMBS market where people are trading bonds that are utterly worthless that they think are worth something. How do I know it's utterly worthless? Because I'm involved in the loan itself and I see what's actually going on. I know on a specific loan that there's X amount of dollars in capital required that the servicer is not disclosing to the bondholders, right? And the bondholders, they're trading as if it's money good. And oh, by the way, the appraisal came in way higher than the debt. And what's going on here? Who's gaining from this? I don't understand how it benefits anyone. Now, of course, I know who's gaining from it. But the point remains is that there are so many underlying festering issues that are problems. So let's put this in very simple terms, okay? I'm not going to apologize ahead of time for all the people and they get all upset at me right now, but go enjoy yourself. Talk to any real estate owner in a moment of truth, and they will tell you they're having trouble in their portfolio. Talk to every lender in a moment of truth, they'll tell you they're having trouble in their portfolio. Yet, we're seeing trades in the 80s on debt pools, trades in the 90s, and the reasoning doesn't compute. It doesn't compute. It's a whole lot of circle talk. It doesn't add up. Now, could it turn out there was no need for worry because it figured itself out? Sure. I can climb Mount Everest without a harness as well. And everything could turn out perfect. Dead clock is right twice a day. I'd take the better odds personally. So I believe we have significant issues. I believe, like Sam Zell said, that lenders are not equipped to solve them. As much as we think that they are, it's not equipped to solve them. I don't think we've changed that much from the 80s and 90s as it relates to how we think about, how real estate people think about property, to say that the effects of what happened then is not going to happen now. I don't think Donald Trump is going to be real estate lender, real estate owner in chief and start doing something to make things better just because he showed up. I don't think there's going to be that much of a ripple effect on the macro to the micro. And no matter how macro you are, commercial real estate is an alternative asset class. So it just doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense to me. And I could just talk about what I see on a day-to-day basis. So I'm sure there's many healthy properties out there. And many of them have festering issues and many of them don't. And many of those that do have festering issues, they'll resolve itself. Many that don't, festering issues will come to the surface. So to what extent, to what level, I don't know. Will it happen? I don't know. But what I will tell you is that anyone is so sure that we're good. Anyone is going out buying things at 90 cents on a dollar, debt at 90 cents on a dollar, pools at 90 cents on a dollar, don't consider me your investor.
Yeah, I think it's challenging because there are conflicting signals, right? If you do look at the macro, you have very strong GDP, inflation essentially coming down, but there are concerns that they'll spike up again. You have an easy monetary environment focusing on commercial real estate. You have very robust securitizations and new issuance activities. You have spreads at historic tights and many notable trades that look actually quite good in terms of pricing. But then I guess if you get deeper, but then on the flip side, banks are still not lending, but what are they doing? They're actually ramping up either their CECL losses or also moving things around into their troubled debt restructuring line item and their modifications. And I would just say overall, like loan activity, even if securitizations are there, it's not enough to really move the market. So I totally see the conflicting. I think you could argue either side. And I think you did a very good job of explaining some of your concerns about the market. Is this something that you would expect to play out in time or, you know, and it's inevitable? Or is it something that we would almost need a bump? And maybe it's a small bump, maybe it's a big bump that would ultimately really reveal and expand some of the cracks that are there.
What I'll say is like this, and I'm going to acknowledge everything you've said to be 100% accurate, right? But I'm going to give you a bit of a contrast in how I think about things compared to how most people think about it. And both are right, but they look at different points, different data points. You've spoken about spreads. You've spoken about levels of financing. So let's take that point. So if someone were to use that argument about levels of financing, and I'm not jumping down your throat per se, I'm just using it as an example as you put it out
please.
There.
Yeah, please.
So when there's less securitizations, that means there's less people putting money into the product because there's more money available for the product to be more securitizations, supply and demand game, right? Because the guys putting out the money, they don't really care what happens. They put it on the line for 2 days and it's out the door. So that spreads is a matter like there's, because there's less securitizations and there's more people in the market, right? So you got to compete for the best product. So everyone wants the best product at the highest yield, right? That's basically what it comes down to. I'm thinking about this from a practical perspective. I'm a borrower, do I have enough cash flow? Could I refinance when it needs to be refinanced, right? Like I had a call today with a borrower who says he's got a Freddie loan and it's worth the debt, but he's out his money and he doesn't want to continue pumping in any money, right? Yeah, the lender could recover, maybe you could, maybe. But on paper, it looks like it's worth the debt and his money goes, so let's trade 100 cents on a dollar. But is it about people pricing in expenses, people pricing in certain concerns that come out of it, right? So the point I'm making is that you need to look at it from a practical perspective. The difference between, and I'm going to go into a pet peeve of mine, okay? Commercial real estate is not an asset class to be looked at on a macroeconomic level because there's so many things that could happen between the macroeconomic to you, because what happens is that for the macroeconomic to hit you, you need an individual to get paid or not get paid or have less payment to be able to either spend product to pay a retail, spend on product to pay the retailer, to pay the manufacturer, or to be able to pay the rent or be able to upgrade to a vet or pay higher rent, et cetera. So it has to go through a process to get to you, right? It's indirect. Actually, people that are in the market, manufacturing companies, get hit much quicker than commercial real estate. Conversely, they get the benefit much quicker.
Yeah.
Not only that, but there's a lag period because we have leases for the most part other than hospitality. And hospitality, if you're looking at different types of hospitality, people don't realize, people in the hospitality business do realize, but there's many different types. There's transient, and transient is business travel. There's leisure travel, right? There's leisure, there's extreme leisure, vacation, where it's just basically you go for 5 days, so to speak. It's different things, visiting family versus that. There's contracts. There's many different ways to look at things, right? And then different hotels have higher levels of F&B than others. And these are various different factors that enter into this macro, right? Commercial real estate has to be looked at from a macro perspective to understand what's happening in the market, but you can't use it to predict necessarily. You have to take the macro, then you look at your micro and say, where am I different than the market and why? And that'll help you better understand it. I don't think macro is the right way to look at things in commercial real estate. I know institutions need to look at a macro because in order for me to sell a product, a securitization, I've got to issue a prospectus. For me to issue a prospectus, it can't be a book on what commercial real estate is. It has to basically be refined into solid little asset classes and or sub-asset classes, and it has to be refined into little blurbs, so to speak. I'm sorry. There's a word for it that I will not say, and it doesn't smell good. So I'm sorry, it's fooling people because ultimately, who's the ultimate investor in this? It's Joe the fireman. It's John the cop, right? It's Gloria the teacher, right? Her savings are going into this stuff, and there are people just going and investing it based on macro. And yes, there's so many, you spread the risk and all that stuff. So I don't buy this whole macro thing, especially when you have a changing market. And then there's the next question of these legacy assets, they got to flow out of the system. So what are you saying? You're going to be the one guy who's going to dispose all his legacy assets at par or at break even and buy everything else at a good price that is only going to go up. No way. Not going to happen. You're going to be the one guy that's not going to have LPs that are going to have losses that are going to pull their money to offset other stuff. So the whole system has got an issue. The issue is legacy assets. The issue is that prices were inflated. The issue is that you can make whatever assumptions you want moving forward on the macro level, which I totally disagree with, but I could be totally wrong because who knows, right? But you can't disagree with the fact that there are legacy assets that are holding you down. And those legacy assets, at some point, someone's going to have to take a loss on all those assets that we see. Oh, most of office will be okay. Most of office will be okay, or half office. Oh, let's even say multifamily. Oh, the syndication multifamily is an issue. The rest of them will be okay. So let's think about that for a second. How many of these loans were syndications? How many of the loans that will come to market will be syndications that will put a downward pressure on the market, downward pressure on value because there's so much product hitting the market at one time, or because lenders pushed it off? Because the one thing you can push off are maturities. The one thing you can push off is disposing of assets because at a certain point, you're losing to the risk-free rate. So when that hits the market, you will have more product, which will push values down. To say that you're immune from that doesn't work. That's why I think we're living in a not a bubble per se where it's going to pop, but people are living in an insulated in a bubble where they're not taking a critical look at it. You know why? Because the job requires them not to take that critical look. So otherwise, what are they supposed to do? Sit home? That's why for me, my focus is on distress. This is when I do well. And I hope it solves itself because quite frankly, that's going to give me liquidity for the deals that I see because I see deals other people don't. So I don't in any way hope that people get hurt. But I see what's out there right now. And you really need to be a really good operator that can turn things around. You can't be that syndicator's like, oh, my management company screwed me. Well, management company couldn't have screwed you if you would have been on top of it, right? So these are the things that need to be focused on and how I look at it. And you hit a bit on a pet peeve. I gave you a fair warning on it, but you went right in.
Yep.
So you're brave man. Let's go.
Yeah. And I guess, are there any signs of changes in the restructuring process that you've seen that you think will play out going forward, whether that is just longer resolution times or maybe different approaches to negotiations? Were there any themes or trends that have recently been popping up that you think you might put in your playbook going forward?
I can't say that I've seen anything really new pop up. I'm seeing acceptance of some older strategies starting to pop up. I'm seeing realization, just various stages of grief, right? So I'm seeing acceptance and conversations being had, less of a cognitive dissonance on behalf of lenders, more of a realism on behalf of borrowers where they're not going to pump in money, more good money after bad, because they've waited so long for the market to turn around and it hasn't happened. So obviously it's never going to happen, right? So I'm seeing a lot of that. So that's the first step in a process. The system has to clean itself. And I honestly really hate talking about it in a clinical way because I talk to borrowers every day and guys are like struggling. They're like, I know I have an invoice out for tens of thousands of dollars with you, but just give me a few more days because I'm actually putting together the money. I'm seeing that lenders are finally starting to see that you can't get water from a rock. And while they're still trying to, don't get me wrong, deep down, they see that they're going to have to work with the guys, with these borrowers, and the conversations are happening. The resolutions, not as quick, because lenders have all the time in the world to figure it out and do it right. But ultimately, at the end of the day, there are deals to be had. But make no mistake, if you're a borrower out there, this will be the toughest negotiation you'll ever be involved because you're going to be emotionally involved. You have all this money invested in it. The lender's not going to ever say, you know what, Joe? You did a great job. And let me tell you, the market is terrible. And let me tell you even more is that I think you could turn it around and I believe in you, but here's the deal. I need another 200% of what you're offering me. It's not going to happen that way. It's going to be like, no way, you got to pay me. And every last dollar, if you don't pay me, we're going to foreclose and then we're going to go after all these, right? The threats are there. And quite frankly, lenders can say what they want. They fulfilled their end of the bargain for the most part. If they've released the cash at closing, you got it. Now, there's a set of obligations you've got to keep to them.
And do you see any opportunities for innovation? Innovation in terms of like an approach or strategy, as well as innovation from the almost like the tech or the data side that you think would be able to help find resolutions or help avoid issues in the first place?
No, at this point, I don't see it. I think there's a lot of improvement that could be done on the lender side with regards to tracking things and being on top of processes. I think there's a lot of things that should happen from the lender side. I think they're on the borrower side. Borrowers need to get better systems. They need to spend more on infrastructure. Everyone could own a property now. Great. Not really how it's supposed to be, right? You need to work hard to succeed. And just because you worked hard to find a deal and convince people to invest in it, that's great. You did work hard. But what's the talent you brought to the table other than convincing people, right? Borrowers need to do a better job at managing this stuff, and that could involve technology, that could involve data. And lenders need to do a better job in staying on top of things and also being a bit more proactive, and not just by saying no, but by actually trying to work with the lenders. But it's at the edges because the context of the question you've asked, you're expecting me potentially to say, yeah, sure, no problem. If we can have a database of all retail spaces and the average rents that people bring in place and average CIs, and we could extrapolate. Obviously, you didn't ask the specific question, but generally, you're looking for something around that line. Everyone that's listening to this is saying like, oh yeah, what's that next thing with data that I could work a little less or basically perform a bit better? And the answer is prop tech is a lot of what they call vaporware, a lot of vaporware, okay? Even, you know, services out there that have data services, that's garbage in, garbage out. It's always updated. It's just a good reference point, something you got to work on and improve upon, as any local broker will tell you. So, yeah, I just don't see that there's some magic bullet out there that's going to change anything, including turning around the assets. I mean, you just need to be smart about what it is that you're spending money on and what the payoff's going to be and what the distance is from how things were done to how you want things to be done and how you're going to bridge that gap. Because while people could accept it and think it's cool, they need to invest in it. And if they need to invest in it, the question is, how are they going to justify investing in it?
Excellent answer. It was a challenging question. I got two more for you, but for folks that are not as deep in the weeds in CRE debt or particularly in the kind of the workout or restructuring space, how would you recommend that they stay up to date on developments, or are there any sources that you follow? I could probably say TREP is probably one of them, but is there anything that you would recommend for either more junior folks or folks that have spent their entire side on the equity side?
What I would say is it's extremely difficult because you need to have to understand it from a different perspective. You could follow the news. You could read the various reports. TREP is a great resource, their podcast. I know Lightbox is now a podcast as well that talks about a lot of distress, a lot of financing things. Obviously, your podcast for sure. It's got a lot of information. No, but it's not only because of distress. It's because you need to see all sides of the picture, right? So on one end, you have a guy saying, oh, it's terrible, X, Y, and Z. Now then you have someone saying, it's great. You need two perspectives. Like, you listen to my perspective. He basically needs to, I don't know, you have to pop some pills. What's this guy, Shlomo? What is he doing to me over here? He's killing me. My whole portfolio is garbage. I spent all this time. What am I going to do with it? So I that's that. But don't, one should not fool themselves to believe that makes them an expert. Because if they think they're an expert, let them just go into TREP and start opening the docs beneath the surface and try reading it. And then they'll be shaken right back to where they need to be, which is know your line, focus on your line, know what you're looking for, understand what you're looking to accomplish, and work with good people. Let's take the most complex type of debt, which is CMBS. You have a originator, you have a master servicer, you have a special servicer, you have bondholders, you have different levels of bondholders, right? And the conversations, obviously the originator is out of the picture for the most part, other than potential buybacks for issues, but I'm not going to get into that. They're out of the picture for the most part. But the master and special, there's a natural competition between the two for various reasons. And then the special and the bondholders is multiple bondholders. There's some bondholders that don't have control, but have tremendous influence in the industry. The other bondholders that have control, and they can't just get the special services to do everything they want because these rating agencies that oversee it, right? But every decision has got to check the boxes to anyone that possibly can have a impact on the process. You need to think about all those moving parts. Yeah. It's a full-time job, I can tell you. And it's very hard to even understand it. And there's so many people that come and they think they understand it. This is what I'm busy with. If I was going to be a plumber, I'd be the best plumber you've ever gotten because I know exactly every type of pipe and everything that needs to be done. And if you want to be good at what you do, you need the best guy at what you do. So because it's only 24 hours in a day and you're actually trying to be the best at what it is that you do, you need to focus on what it is the best that you actually are good at, the best at, right? And that's the key thing. So I would say you need to work with the right people. You need to understand. You need to trust the people that you work with that give you the opinions that you need. And that's key. And then you need to follow them, to be very frank with you. You need to have that vision. Know where you're going. Know what your good-to-haves are. Know what your need-to-haves are. Know what you can live with and what you can't live with. And trust the people that tell you that they can or cannot deliver it.
That's excellent. And so final question, because we like to ask all our guests the same question. If you could snap your fingers and have any change to the industry come true, what would that be?
Okay, this is going to be a little scathing, but the loan industry, the lending industry is broken. Very simple. Okay, the lending industry has a bipolar relationship between lender and borrowers. A lender, when they're lending to you, they're your best buddy. Obviously, if you look at the doc sometimes, you realize that they're setting themselves up for their own favor, but they're your best buddy. If there's ever an issue down the road, even if there isn't an issue when it comes time to servicing, they'll be friendly with you. But ultimately, it's you against them. It's basically there's no like, let's work together type thing. And the reason for that is actually pretty simple. Lender liability is something that people are really concerned about, right? You want to tell a borrower what to do, and the borrower says, well, I know in my docs say otherwise, but you told me to do this, right? You don't want to do that. But there's got to be a way around it because recovery rates are too low. Here's what happens. Every 10, 15 years, we got this depression, right? Not depression, rather recession, a real estate recession, and recoveries come down significantly. Oh, we underwrote wrong. Oh, we gave too much money. Oh, we gave too many cash outs. Oh, those stories are all there. When in reality, so many of these problems could have been fixed if the moment after you gave a loan to the borrower, you sent someone down to the office, you sat down and said, listen, here's the thing, right? Here's what these loan documents require. I don't know if your attorney told you or not, but here's a list of it in plain, simple English. You're going to sign a disclaimer and you're going to say that this is not overriding the loan documents. You need an attorney to override it and bring your attorney, whatever it is. You got to find a way so that the borrower knows what exactly you expect for them and what your process is going to be. Because absent that, you will have defaults. Not everybody will default because there's a lot of really competent people. And being competent doesn't mean that you got it right the first time. It means that you can recover as needed and resolve the situation. But at the same time, there's a lot of lender processes that are problems, right? Are you telling me that with every person that took a loan over the past, I don't know, 100 years, that there was never two loans that overlapped, that had different terms, and at the same time, there was never a change in internal process on the lender side that changed how they dealt with the borrower, that didn't put a borrower's operations into disarray? So the answer is it needs to be an open line of communication, an open line of coaching. And I believe very strongly that default rates can be cut in an impactful way. It doesn't mean 20% cut, but in an impactful way, there's certain loans that could be saved when borrowers just know what to do. So many borrowers are like, this happened and the lender called me and now they want this. And I said, you're crazy. And then they said, no, you're crazy. And then they filed. Then all of a sudden they have a property that's not being watched and it's in default. And okay, let's sue them for waste or whatever else the lender will do to recover that money. But that's a problem. It never should have happened. So quite frankly, this tribalism, this protecting oneself to the extent of hurting oneself needs to stop. There has to be a collaboration in a much better way. And it needs to be done from the time that you get your initial quote and need to be handheld. Because like it or not, okay, we only lend to better borrowers. Please. I've seen your better borrowers and they're not better. So this is something that needs to be worked on. And I don't know that it will be worked on, but if there's something I could change to make an impact, that's what it would be.
I just certainly do hope that you can make an impact there because I think that it very much is needed. But Shlomo, thank you so much for being with us today. I think that's all the time we have, but thank you for joining us and sharing your time. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, tax, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.